He chugged a full can. Half a sausage pizza had congealed on the stovetop from earlier, so he finished it off while checking his phone. Kevin still uses Ubuntu, LOL. It was a text from David. He was binging classic anime with their other friends at Kevin's house. Anime sucked, and Rodrigo was glad to be missing it. Except, he didn't totally think it sucked. He liked Attack on Titan when they forced him to watch it last year, but he couldn't help it. Something inside him made him pretend that he didn't. "I wouldn't even put that distro on mi abuela's computer," Rodrigo replied. David LOL'd again. Their friends were a joke when it came to operating systems. Not that David was much better. He tried to keep up with Rodrigo, but nobody around here could. In elementary school, Rodrigo had jailbroken iPhones and Kindles for extra cash. Now he had 8 different payware games on all the app stores. His latest, a dumb game about popping rainbow bubbles, was raking it in. "Been so lame you need me to keep you entertained?" Rodrigo asked. "Nah, we're watching Cowboy Bebop. It's cool." Rodrigo had vaguely heard of it, but he researched its plot as he moved into the bathroom to take a piss. It was some space cowboy bullshit. He didn't bother replying. He checked his favorite message board, but the usual torch and pitchfork crowd were still up in arms over this new company of video game developers that was run entirely by women. His inside shrank with a familiar shame as he quickly left the page. Not that long ago, he'd been one of them. He cringed as he remembered what he'd said to Makani Young. "I'll give you a ride home, sweetheart." If his sisters had heard it, they would have kicked him in the cojones. But the line had just slipped out, a knee-jerk, base-level wisecrack. He wasn't that guy anymore. He still didn't understand how he'd ever been that guy. He walked back into the living room and found that his gaming rocker was facing the wrong direction. Strange. He didn't remember tripping over it. Rodrigo turned it around, plopped down, and put on his headphones. The game's death metal pause music blasted in his ears. Had Makani told Alex what he'd said? Probably, which sucked. Alex was smart and sexy, and kind of mean, but mean in the same way he was. And sometimes it seemed like she might like him back. A powerful buzz hit his system. At first he thought it was from imagining Alex in her torn fishnets, until he realized it must be the energy drink. His bloodstream glowed electric. Rodrigo unpaused the game. A zombie shot out from the closet cubicle, but he was ready, and he hacked off its emaciated head. He ran through the dilapidated office with his machete aimed high. He was invincible. An hour later, Rodrigo was asleep. Somehow, he'd managed to pause the game before he crashed, but he didn't get up. He fell asleep with his headphones still on, the music still pulsing and thrashing. The sunlight streamed in through the glass back doors. It was so bright that it was painful. Rodrigo squinted, blocking the assault with his hand, and knocked over a full can of Jacked. The chartreuse liquid spilled across his mother's immaculate Mexican rug. Shit! Rodrigo uprighted the aluminum can, but the liquid had already stopped beating. It was seeping into the threads. He lurched to his feet, but the headphones cord yanked him back down, and he fumbled to throw off the whole contraption. His ears rang in the emptiness of the house. Death metal pumped quietly from the headphones on the floor. He didn't even remember grabbing another energy drink. He only remembered the one that he'd chugged in the kitchen. A headache ruptured his brain. Was it possible to get a hangover from energy drinks? He turned off the music, and the silence was a cathedral. Rodrigo rubbed his eyeballs through his lids with the palms of his hands. When he opened them, the pinpricks disappeared, but something wasn't right. He was in his living room, Except he wasn't. Or was he turned around? Instead of facing the television, his gaming rocker was facing the couch. Rodrigo looked behind himself. The television was sitting on its stand in the middle of the room. Dead center. There was a pause of incomprehension. And then his mind snowballed with panic. All at once his gaze absorbed the rest of the room. The two chairs that flanked the couch had been switched. The coffee table was blocking the sliding doors. The fiddle-leaf fig had been moved from beside the doors to the opposite wall, and the floor lamp, usually nestled beside the couch, had been placed beside the fiddle-leaf fig. His rocker was the only piece of furniture in the correct place. Rodrigo's heartbeat pounded inside his ears as he tried to piece everything together, tried to make sense of it. David. It seemed like the sort of prank he'd pull. He had a weird, unpredictable side that Rodrigo didn't always like. Or maybe Sophia, his youngest and most irritating sister, the one who'd finally moved into an apartment at the end of summer. Sophia! He rose to his feet. David? Are you still here? The house didn't answer. Ah, very funny, you got me. The house still didn't answer. What the shit? Rodrigo mumbled as he stepped straight into a puddle. In his shock, he'd forgotten about the spilled drink. He jogged to the kitchen for paper towels, but they weren't in the holder underneath the high cabinets. They were sitting on the center of the island. Rodrigo knew that he should laugh. Whoever this was, they'd gotten him again. But he couldn't. Not yet. Maybe because no one had jumped out to yell gotcha and point their finger. Had he moved everything last night? It was possible. Maybe. He checked all the doors just in case. They were locked. He jogged a little faster as he checked the windows. The one in the guest bathroom was open. His blood turned cold. Not Sophia, then. She still had a key. David or Kevin? Rodrigo released a foul stream of expletives, realizing it was probably all his friends, those fucking assholes, getting revenge on him for turning down their stupid anime fest. That's why David had texted him at midnight. They were checking to see if he was still awake. Rodrigo circled the interior of his house, waiting for them to appear. But the rooms were empty. Rationally, Rodrigo knew that this prank was genius. Breaking into someone's house in the dead of night to rearrange their furniture while they slept? He wished he'd thought of it. It would have scared the hell out of Sophia. But the reality of it wasn't funny. There were no silly notes, no "Are you awake?" texts, no red lipsticked warnings on his bathroom mirror. The whole situation felt off. Instinct told him to call the police, but that was dumb, wasn't it? He checked his phone for the 100th time, and when there weren't any messages, he sent a text to the whole group. LOL, you got me. Who did it? There was an electronic ding, and Rodrigo spun around, yelling and tripping over his feet as he stumbled backward in fear. A slender figure stood motionless in his kitchen. Their slouched back was facing him, and they were wearing a hoodie with the hood up. Hey! Rodrigo's voice came out as a croak. The figure didn't move. Rodrigo hated that he felt so terrified. Whoever this was, he was about to be pissed at them. The person was too skinny to be one of his sisters. He crept forward. David? Is that you? The figure didn't move. Emily? She was the smallest in his group of friends. He felt ashamed to think about her hearing the tremor in his speech, but the figure, it was so unnaturally still. What if it wasn't someone he knew? His white socks touched the edge of the kitchen floor. His T-shirt was damp with sweat. He reached out to touch the figure's shoulder. The killer spun around and lunged. The knife went straight into Rodrigo's heart and back out, a shuck-shuck that sunk him to his knees. And then the blade stabbed him in the back again and again and again. Rodrigo gasped and then gurgled. And then nothing. The body lay on the floor like a slaughtered calf. Blood pooled beneath it. The white cabinets were sprayed with a gory red, and the thickest drops trickled down the doors like tears. The killer lifted the deflated carcass under its arms and dragged it to the living room, propped it in the rocker, sawed off its ears. The ears were stuffed into the headphones, and then the headphones were placed onto the head. The killer sat on the rug, crisscross applesauce, picked up the abandoned controller, and unpaused the game. There was no hurry. No one would be home for hours. Chapter 12. Rodrigo Morales changed everything. In the early hours of Monday morning, the students of Osborne High were instructed not to come to school. Classes were canceled until further notice. Students were urged to stay home or, if their parents would be at work, stay in the home of a trusted friend. It wasn't safe to be alone. In the wake of this developing tragedy, the official texts, emails, and voicemails all repeated this same illogical and clunky phrase. No information was provided regarding the third victim, but the town's collective mind was many-tentacled and far-reaching. The Morales family had neighbors, several of whom had been startled awake by flashing police lights shortly after 2 a.m. At breakfast, everybody followed the story on two screens, phone and television. Bacani jumped as a plate was set down in front of her. She'd only been tangentially aware of Grandma Young, still in her pajamas and plush robe, mixing ingredients and cooking on the stovetop. Bacani blinked at the short stack of pancakes. "Oatmeal pumpkin," her grandmother said. Their usual breakfast was whole wheat toast or a bowl of fiber cereal. Bacani didn't need to ask why the change. Pancakes kept her grandmother occupied while they waited for information. Pancakes gave her a task to do with her hands in a world that seemed more and more out of her control. And pancakes showed Bacani that, even though the world was frightening, she was loved. If only Bacani had an appetite. The cloying sweetness of the maple syrup made her nose ache and her stomach turn. Rodrigo. That was the rumor. The guy who'd insulted her 5 days ago on the quad. The guy she'd spoken to 3 days ago in physics class. Alex's weird crush. Rodrigo. He couldn't be dead because he was still so alive in her mind. Bacani had already texted Alex. It was her first attempt to contact her since Darby's confrontation, and she had yet to receive a reply. Now she felt guilty for ignoring their texts over the weekend. "Well?" Grandma Young asked. "Thank you," Bacani said automatically. She'd forgotten about the pancakes. "I meant, is there anything new?"
"Just in. We can confirm a third victim in the Osborne slayings,"
Creston Howard said from the living room, and they lunged toward him.
"A 17-year-old senior, Rodrigo Ramon Morales Ontiveros."
His full name. Bacani's knees buckled. He would never be just Rodrigo again. "Oh, Lord." Grandma Young covered her mouth with both hands. The news showed live footage from the crime scene. Two officers in heavy coats stood outside of a one-story rancher with a frosted lawn, discussing something with crossed arms. Neighbors huddled in the foggy street behind a banner of yellow tape. Creston spoke over the feed.
The boy's parents discovered his body in the early hours of the morning after returning home from a weekend trip to Las Vegas. Police say it appears that he died from knife-related trauma, which has led them to believe the case is connected, though they have yet to disclose if his body faced similar mutilation.
Makani lowered herself, stunned, into the easy chair. Her grandmother placed a hand on her shoulder.
Hang on, Diane Platt said, and the screen cut back to Creston's co-anchor in the studio. We've just received word that all Osborne schools are now closed for the day. Parents of middle and elementary school students are being asked to pick up their children immediately, and the police have issued a warning for them to not be left unsupervised until whoever is responsible has been taken into custody.
Grandma Young's willowy hand clenched into a hard grip. Makani stared at the television in despair, but she could no longer see it. Her vision swam. His family. His friends. Alex. Oh, my God, Alex.
I taught his sisters.
Her grandmother's voice cracked.
I can't.
Makani stood to embrace her, choking back tears as Grandma Young collapsed into her arms. Creston and Diane repeated their updates. Makani peered over her grandmother's shoulder and out the large window that looked across their front lawn. She scanned the yards for the boogeyman, the Babadook, Ted Bundy. The street was empty. A misty chill radiated from the window pane. Had it been this cold when the killer slipped away from Rodrigo's house? Had the killer finally left behind some evidence in the frost? Makani's bare feet were almost numb. Her hope felt even colder. The ice crystals melted from the vegetation, but the morning remained bleak. Businesses switched their open signs to closed. Parents stayed at home and locked their doors. Fear clouded the air as panic threatened to storm. Everyone had known Matt, and plenty had known Haley, but few had known Rodrigo. He wasn't popular. Most people remembered him as a smartass who actually happened to be smart. He'd never had a girlfriend, and his small group of friends rarely socialized with other groups. Overnight, every student had become a potential target. The story went national. Three murders had given Osborne a serial killer, and not just any serial killer, but the media's favorite kind, someone who committed heinous acts on attractive teenagers. The news spread like wildfire. Makani heard Chief Pilger's official statement during a rundown on CNN.
The Osborne PD is pursuing several leads. The killer will be apprehended, and he or she will face the full punishment of the law. If anyone has any information regarding these crimes, please call this number.
Ollie called around noon. Grandma Young was in her bedroom on the phone with a church friend, and Makani was still parked in front of the television. Ollie was at the police station performing menial tasks for his brother. Chris didn't want him to be alone, but it was also a punishment for ditching school on Friday. Ollie was stuck there until his afternoon shift at Greeley's, assuming the grocery store stayed open. Makani pressed him for details. Is it true that they have some leads?
Sort of, Ollie said. The police don't want to reveal too much to the public, but the killer left behind two imprints in the blood on the Morales' living room rug. A partial of a boot and a partial of the seat of his jeans, which included fibers.
He paused. Makani could tell he was holding something back.
It's sick, he said, lowering his voice. But after the murder, he stayed to play Battleground Apocalypse on Rodrigo's PlayStation.
Makani's heart picked up speed.
He? Sorry, that's still speculation.
It's just the most likely possibility. Backtracking, her mind finally absorbed his previous statement. The killer stayed at the crime scene? To play a video game?
Yep. They sat in Rodrigo's blood, right beside his dead body, and played Rodrigo's game for 5 hours.
5 hours?
5 hours.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It was impossible to imagine. That might be the most fucked up thing I've ever heard.
At least it means the killer was finally careless and left something behind.
There weren't any fingerprints on the controller?
No. And most of Rodrigo's were smudged off. The killer probably wears gloves, but the police had already guessed that.
Makani was still thinking about the type of person who could sit beside a hacked and slashed body for 5 hours. If the killer stayed there for so long, they must not have been concerned with getting caught. They must have known that Rodrigo's parents were out of town. They must have...
known Rodrigo before the attack. Yeah. All three murders have been so personal, not to mention that killing someone with a knife is significantly more intimate than using a gun, he added, sounding like his cop brother. So it doesn't seem probable that the killer is some random crazy drifter. It's probably someone they all knew.
Someone we know. An unintelligible voice in the background interrupted their conversation.
Okay, okay, Ollie said with his phone pulled away from his mouth. Sorry.
He was back on the line.
Chris wants me to get back to organizing his files.
Oh, yeah. Neither of them said goodbye. Hey, her stomach tore open like a buzzing wasp nest. I miss you. His response was silence. The wasps dropped dead. But then he spoke, and she could hear him smiling.
I miss you too.
When they hung up, she clutched her phone against her chest. It vibrated, and the sensation startled her. A long, garbled text had arrived from Darby. The feed and seed was open. He was meeting Alex there for work, and he'd update her again after seeing Alex in person. All morning they'd been pretending like their fight had never happened. It was more important to make sure that Alex was okay. She still hadn't texted Makani, but she'd made contact with Darby. Makani tried not to feel hurt by this. A crocheted throw materialized over her legs.
You looked cold, Grandma Young said.
She sat down on the sofa, on the side nearest to Makani's chair. Makani pulled up the blanket with a shiver. Thank you. Have you spoken with your parents yet? No, she shook her head. But I will. Grandma Young had given strict instructions to call them both when they were awake, to let them know that she was safe. Makani dreaded it. She wanted sympathy and crocheted throws, not her parents. With the 5-hour difference, it was 7:30 a.m. on the Kona coast. People were out of bed and checking their phones. Would her old friends notice Osborne in the news? Even if they did, they wouldn't make the connection. No one would recognize the name of the town. No one, except for Jasmine. Makani and Jasmine had once been as close as Darby and Alex, but now Makani knew that even the strongest of friendships cracked under pressure, and her bedrock with Darby and Alex wasn't nearly so thick. She had to see Alex. She had to make the effort, because otherwise, Alex might stop making the effort in return. Can I borrow the car this afternoon? Makani's question seemed loud and abrupt. I'd only be gone for an hour.
May you borrow?
Despite her alarm, Grandma Young still had to correct Makani's grammar. And what in heaven's name is so important? Her best chance of succeeding was to tell the truth. She did. The heavy tick of the grandfather clock permeated the house as Grandma Young weighed her decision.
I can't let you take the car and go alone,
She held up a hand to stop Makani's protests. But I will drive you there myself. Holly went to work at Greeley's Foods, and Darby and Alex went to the feed and seed. Even in times of crisis, humans and animals needed to eat, and teenagers earning minimum wage needed to be there to ring up the sales. The sky was dim and overcast. The feed and seed was located on the outskirts of town, and Makani arrived shortly after her friends had begun their shift. The store smelled grainy, with a fetid, tangy undertone of livestock, though it contained no animals. Alex's eyes were smeared and wholly rimmed with charcoal eyeshadow and black mascara, evidence of crying. Darby sat beside her on a stool behind the long sales counter, as somber as a grave. It was less embarrassing to be in public with her grandmother than Makani had expected. Grandma Young made her feel safer. The Osborne Slayer, as the media had dubbed the killer, wasn't stalking Makani, apart from Ollie. Her only local connections were here, surrounded by enormous bags of food pellets, but her nerve endings were frayed all the same. The musty scent of foreboding clung to the town like mold on a decaying house. It was impossible not to breathe its stench into her lungs. Near a display of pasture pumps, two middle-aged men wearing Carhartt overalls and matching frowns spoke in low, tense voices. They were the store's only customers. Normally, the feed and seed would be bustling, and the ranchers and farmers would be booming jovially as they swapped stories. Makani didn't need to hear what the two men were whispering to know that they weren't talking about football or the weather. Darby's posture lifted when he noticed Makani and her grandmother. "Hey," she said awkwardly. She wasn't sure where else to start. "What are you doing here?" And then, remembering his manners, he added, "Hi, Mrs. Young." Grandma Young nodded hello.
"We came to see how you're doing," Makani said to Alex. She corrected herself. "How you're both doing?"
"Pretty shitty," Alex drew out the rhyme. Makani glanced at her grandmother, but Grandma Young didn't blink. It was neither the time nor place to criticize. Sometimes swearing was acceptable.
"I'm sorry."
Makani reached across the counter to squeeze Alex's limp hand, injecting as much compassion into it as she could. They conversed with their eyes. Alex didn't say anything, but Makani could tell that the gesture was meaningful to her. Grandma Young had engaged Darby in a series of questions.
"Yeah, my parents are freaking out," he said. "They didn't want me to come here today."
"Oh!" Grandma Young's posture changed, like she'd remembered something important. She pivoted back toward Makani.
"Your parents called while you were in the shower, both of them."
Her tone was accusatory, but Makani's avoidance had turned into genuine forgetfulness. Momentarily, she was surprised that her parents had seen the news, though she wasn't surprised that they'd called her grandmother, asking about her, instead of asking her directly. They'd met humanity's minimum requirement.
"Sorry, Grandma," she said.
Grandma Young cocked an eyebrow.
"What about Oliver? I'm sure you didn't forget to call him. Is he all right?"
Alex's hand grew rigid. Makani released it and stuffed her fists into her coat pockets.
"He's fine," she mumbled. "I shouldn't have let go. I should have pretended like this wasn't a thing."
But Grandma Young wouldn't stop talking.
"I'm glad he came over this weekend. I don't know why he'd put that thing in his lip, but he's a nice boy."
It was the worst possible moment for her to defend Ollie's character. Makani cringed, holding her breath, as Darby and Alex exchanged a dark look. They hadn't known that she'd seen him again. She neutralized her expression and prayed that they wouldn't use this opportunity to report their insane suspicions to her grandmother. They didn't.
After another silent communication and a warning glance at Makani, Darby changed the subject.
Do you think school will be canceled again tomorrow?
Her legs weakened in relief. They should cancel it for the rest of the week. Matt was killed on school grounds. Alex kicked her toe against the counter, pointedly avoiding Makani's gaze. They should cancel it until someone is arrested, assuming the police are looking at every suspect. Before Makani could respond, or even decide how to respond, anger, guilt, and defensiveness warring with her knowledge that Alex was truly suffering, an old man with a cowboy hat and sun-worn wrinkles appeared in the doorway of the manager's office. He was checking to make sure that his employees weren't gossiping instead of helping customers. Grandma Young gave him a nod. Good afternoon, Cyril. He nodded back.
Sabrina?
We'll let you get back to work, she said, as pointedly to Makani as it was to Makani's friends. Please don't hesitate to call us if you need anything. Anything at all. This she directed toward Alex with tenderness. Alex wilted. Darby placed an arm around her shoulders. Makani and her grandmother left, and as the door's decorative cowbell gave its plaintive clang goodbye, the first snowflakes of the year began to fall. Evening crept into town. Patches of white snow gathered in the blue shadows, but the flakes were still melting on the roads and sidewalks. Makani imagined the soft powder drifting onto the memorial at school, dusting the flowers and cards and stuffed lions. Because of classes being canceled, no one had been able to place any tokens on the mound for Rodrigo. It was almost unbearable. The official texts, emails, and voicemails arrived after dusk. All Osborne schools would be closed the following day. Classes would resume on Wednesday, and deputies outsourced from the Sloan County Sheriff's Office would be stationed on each campus. The sky blackened. The snow began to stick. Grandma Young stared out the front window at the quiet street.
Maybe the killer won't strike tonight. They'd leave behind tracks in the snow.
Makani tasted fear in the wind.
Maybe.
They closed the curtains and double-checked the locks. Chapter 13. School was back in session, but the classrooms were half empty. Even Grandma Young had debated whether or not to send Makani, and as a former teacher, she never let her stay home. Makani had to have a fever or be vomiting, neither of which had happened since moving here. Her attendance record was perfect. Her grandmother had only decided in favor of school because of a last-minute call from a sleep specialist in Omaha. They'd had a cancellation and could get her in that afternoon. Apparently, she was more concerned about her sleepwalking than she'd been letting on.
My appointment wasn't for 3 more months. Grandma Young had said, it's impossible to get in. I should go.
Makani had agreed, and when her flustered grandmother had rushed her off to school, Makani didn't mention that she could have gone with her. She'd wanted to go to school. Something about not going felt cowardly, like they were letting the killer win. But as she sat in her deserted first period class, she wondered if she'd lobbied for the wrong choice. Neither Darby nor Alex was here. Darby's parents hadn't let him, and Alex had asked to stay home. A morose spell had been cast over the campus. It felt otherworldly in its emptiness and melancholia. After 3 minutes of silence during the morning announcements, 1 minute for each loss, Principal Stanton, who never did the morning announcements, broke the news that Sweeney Todd had been canceled. He claimed that the decision had been made out of respect for the victims, with special regards to Haley and her family. This was true enough, although everyone understood that a musical about a barber who kills his customers with a straight razor was far too grisly for their grieving community. Makani felt bad for the drama kids who'd been working so hard and looked so crestfallen. Two desks ahead of her, Haley's best friend Brooke lamented, "Haley would have wanted the show to go on." Everywhere. They were everywhere. Those who had left them and those who had been left behind. In second period physics, Makani stared at Rodrigo's empty seat as if it contained a phantom. David sat beside the physical vacancy in hollow silence. The rest of their group, Rodrigo's other friends who'd decided to brave school, kept her focus at lunchtime. Through the strange osmosis of tragedy, she suddenly knew their names, Kevin, Emily, and Jesse. They shared David's anguish, though their body language expressed it in different ways from his numbness. Kevin, fear. Emily, devastation. Jesse, helplessness. Everyone's reaction was unique, including the football players. On game days, they always dressed in button-downs, khakis, and ties, and that's what they'd chosen to wear today. Still a team. But their pressed clothing couldn't disguise their emotional upheaval or how similar their mourning was to the gamers. Hulking Buddy even clapped gangly Kevin on the shoulder as he waited behind him in the pizza line. They'd never been on equal terms before, but now they would forever have this terrible October in common. Social boundaries were being crossed everywhere. Students still ate with their own kind, but each group sat a little closer to the other groups, and they weaved in and out of one another's conversations. They were all talking about the same thing anyway. It was sad that people only got along when everybody was unhappy. Makani and Ollie sat beside each other in the back corner of the cafeteria. Last night's snow had almost completely melted, but no one wanted to be outdoors. It didn't matter that the murders had all taken place indoors. Walking through the open quad felt like wearing a bullseye. It seemed safer to remain in the thick of the crowd, although thick was still relative. They were the only two people at their table. Makani hoped this was because of the low attendance as opposed to a general distrust of Ollie. It was growing in all the students, not just Darby and Alex. Ollie hadn't revealed any outward signs of acknowledgement, but it was impossible for Makani to believe that he hadn't noticed the darted glances and heated murmurs. It had never been so clear that he didn't fit in, and how much that rankled them. Zachary Loop, asshole burnout, and the other frequently rumored suspect had been smart. He'd stayed at home. "I spent the afternoon watching the news with my grandma," Makani said. She slid her fries toward Ollie and hoped that he'd take some. His apple, Ziploc of Cheetos, and peanut butter sandwich seemed especially sad today. "It was depressing. All of those parents and siblings and grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins, all of them being shouted at. How does it feel to know that your son's killer is still at large?" She shook her head. "And yet there we were, waiting to judge and analyze their responses." Ollie dipped a French fry in ketchup. "Thanks." She felt an urgent need to engage him in conversation, aware of the eyes that judged them. They needed to look normal, or at least as normal as was possible today. Ollie's usual demeanor might appear suspiciously calm, though if he seemed happy, that would look inappropriate too. Makani hated that she had to worry about what other people thought of him. "What about you?" she asked. "Were you at the station again?"
"Yeah. But Chris didn't make me work. He wasn't even there. He had to drive to Tecumseh, so I hung out with Ken."
"Ken?"
"The dispatcher."
"Oh. Is he cool?" The question felt dumb. But Makani wanted to know more about Ali's life. Truthfully, she wanted to know everything. They'd exchanged a few texts yesterday, enough for her to know that he'd be coming to school today. Perhaps if she were still being honest, it was the main reason why she'd wanted to come, too. Ali's mouth twitched with a smile.
He's a 50-something thrice-married divorcee who owns 2 ATVs. His favorite show is infomercials.
Makani laughed. His smile turned into a grin. So what's in Tecumseh? Was Chris interviewing a suspect? She paused.
And where's Tecumseh? About 2.5 hours away, past Lincoln. It's the site of the state's only maximum security prison. He was called out for something unrelated. Unexciting.
Your whole day sounds unexciting, Ali repeated. She laughed again. You know, the next time we have a day off, you're welcome to stay at my house instead. It was both a practical suggestion and a flirtatious offer, but Makani quickly realized what else she'd implied. Why would they have another day off? Her expression collapsed. I didn't mean... I hope another person doesn't... Ali nodded. He understood.
Ugh!
Makani thumped her head dramatically against the table.
Everything is the worst.
She turned her head, cheek against tabletop, to look at him. And then he did the best thing. He laid his head against the tabletop, too. They stared at each other, cheeks squashed, noses inhaling the funk of an old cleaning sponge. She wished that she could reach under the table and take his hand, but they'd never shown a public display of affection. That was for boyfriends and girlfriends. She still wasn't sure what this was. She only hoped it would continue. It would feel good to be close to someone again. It would feel good to be close to him. Her phone dinged. Makani swore as they lifted their heads, and she checked the screen. Grandma, just making sure everything's okay. An odd look appeared on Ali's face. What is it? He shook his head.
Something my brother said.
She waited for him to elaborate, and he glanced around before lowering his voice.
Chris told me that they worked in silence at Rodrigo's house, because they were still in shock. The only sound was Rodrigo's phone. It was blowing up with friends who'd heard the rumors and were trying to check in.
Ali shuddered.
Chris said that was the worst part, the part that kept them all on edge, the sound of those unanswered calls and texts.
Oh, man, Makani said softly. That's bleak.
If we could have your attention.
Caleb Greeley and someone else from the religious crowd, a tall, mousy girl that Makani recognized as a junior, were standing on the cafeteria's modest platform stage. Caleb spoke into a microphone. Makani knew what was coming next.
We'd like to lead you in a short prayer for Haley, Matt, and Rodrigo.
Yep. Makani couldn't think of a single instance of prayer during school back in Hawaii, but it happened all the time here, and everyone was expected to participate. That was the part that bothered her. Makani genuinely hoped that others, including her grandmother, found peace and strength through prayer. But she wasn't religious herself, and it made her uncomfortable whenever it was forced upon her. She bowed her head and listened to Caleb and the girl not so much pray as preach. They recited many, many Bible verses. Her annoyance at Caleb rose. First, there was the prayer at the flagpole, then the interview on television. Now this. Was he getting something out of the attention? Was he enjoying the spotlight a little too?
Makani stopped herself. She was doing to him what everyone else was doing to Ali.
Anyone could look sinister when viewed through the lens of fear, even an overly zealous, deeply sincere boy like Caleb. She pushed her suspicions aside, But as another minute dragged by, Makani realized that she could appreciate his goodwill while simultaneously wishing that he would also suggest something they could actually do to help support the victims' families or catch the killer. Prayer alone wasn't action. Underneath the table, someone took her right hand from her lap. Her eyes jolted open. Ollie stared back. She glanced around, but everyone else, even the cafeteria ladies, had their eyes closed. Ollie laced his fingers through hers. She tightened the grip and leaned in. They kissed. Heat and electricity and life spread throughout her body. They opened their mouths and kissed deeper, without sound, surrounded by the prayers of the frightened. When Caleb said amen, their lips pulled away, and they smiled quietly, no one any wiser to their indiscretion. Near the end of the last period, Principal Stanton returned to the loudspeakers to thank everyone for coming today, to remind them that the school would still be open tomorrow, and to announce a small piece of good news. Rosemarie Holt won the barrel race last weekend at the Sloan County Championship Rodeo. McConaughey didn't give a damn about the rodeo, and Rosemarie was a junior in none of her classes, but she cheered along with the rest of her Spanish class. Their universal joy was significantly overheightened. They felt grateful for any good news.
"Watch out, Rosemarie," Ollie said darkly.
The joke rang too true, and the happiness died in Makani's throat.
"The killer likes them talented," he said.
"Don't." She hadn't meant for it to come out so sharply. Ollie looked startled, and the space between them grew awkward.
"Sorry," he said. "I only meant..."
"I know. It's okay." Makani shook her head, trying to smile. She'd understood his meaning instantly. She was upset because someone might have overheard him. She attempted to mend the delicate breach. "Is that something the police are looking into?" He nodded as her phone vibrated, rattling the top of her desk. The noise rattled her, too. Rodrigo's phone, blowing up. Thankfully, it was more good news, this time from her grandmother.
"Still in Omaha. Doc kept me waiting for over an hour just to tell me that I'll have to come back for more tests. I won't be home when school gets out. Would you please ask Darby to stay with you until I get there?"
Makani texted back. "Sure, no worries." This time her grin at Ollie was genuine. "Want to come over to my place?" Chapter 14. They left behind Ollie's car at school and walked to her house, in case Grandma Young came home early and he needed to make a sneaky getaway. The irony was not lost on them that this behavior made them look suspicious, but the sun was shining and the air was crisp with the magic of autumn. Leaves pinwheeled from the sky and swirled across the sidewalk. Mums brightened the dull landscape with vibrant pops of yellow, lavender, and russet. Cheesecloth ghosts hung from invisible string on tree branches. Tombstones with joke names created temporary graveyards, and pumpkins, orange, white, tall, round, flat, and miniature, decorated every porch and door. Halloween was only 3 days away. The afternoon felt like a gift, a respite from the ongoing stress. Their plan was simple. Makani would encourage her grandmother to text updates regarding her arrival time, and when she grew close, Ollie would duck out. Makani would say that Darby had just left because they knew Grandma Young was around the corner, and Darby's parents were anxious to have him home. And then Grandma Young would get mad, but it wouldn't be anything an evening couldn't fix. Puddles of melted snow still rested beneath the oak-lined portion of Walnut Street. The north-south roads in Osborne's oldest neighborhood were all named after trees: cedar, elm, hickory, oak, pine, spruce, walnut, and willow. They'd been christened in alphabetical order so that the townspeople could always find their way home. Lately, Makani felt irrationally relieved that she didn't live on Elm Street. "What did you tell your brother?" she asked.
"That I'm going into work early," Ollie said.
A moment of tension arose as they rounded the side of her house and... Yep, all clear. Her grandmother's gold Taurus wasn't in the driveway. They entered through the back door. The house was quiet. The only sound was its heartbeat, the hefty pendulum of the immense grandfather clock. "It's such an old people house," she whispered.
"I like it," Ollie whispered back.
They didn't have to lower their voices, but they did anyway. Energy crackled between them, intense and irrepressible. "I'm pretty sure the only items made in this century are the ones that moved here with me," she said. He laughed quietly. She led him out of the kitchen and up the stairs.
"She hasn't finished it yet?" he asked.
Makani stopped halfway up.
"The puzzle," he said.
She followed his gaze over the banister and into the living room, where most of the sky pieces, the blues and whites and grays, were still scattered around the coffee table. She shook her head and smiled. "I think she's been waiting for you."
"Next time, I'll visit when she's home."
Makani raised an eyebrow. "Sure you don't want to work on it now?" Ollie bit his lip, let the ring slip back out.
"Positive."
As Makani led him into her bedroom, she sensed his eyes on the curves of her body. She felt his hunger, because it was the same hunger that she felt inside herself. She locked the door behind them, just in case. It reminded her to check her phone, and a new text had arrived from Grandma Young. "Accident on Route 6, stuck in West Omaha traffic." "Traffic sucks. We're in luck." Makani sing-songed it as she plugged her phone into a speaker and turned up the volume. The loud music was also just in case, but Ollie hardly seemed to register it. He seemed taken aback by his surroundings. Uneasy, she crossed her arms over her chest. "What?" Ollie took a moment to collect his thoughts.
"It looks like the rest of the house, not like you. This looks like... you're a visitor."
The shrewd observation stung more than expected. "I suppose I am." Ollie nodded, and she was surprised that the gesture contained disappointment. Her arms uncrossed as she stepped automatically toward him, but he turned away from her. The emotional barrier slammed back into place. He kneeled beside her bed. "What are you?"
"You once told me that I'd find something under here."
At her baffled expression, he added,
"A picture?"
Her eyes widened as she recalled the old swim team photo. His smile gleamed with mischief. "No, no, 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 no." Makani threw her body between him and the bed, pinning down his arms as he struggled for something just out of reach. She couldn't let him see the picture now. Not while she was trying to seduce him. "Next time," she said, laughing. "I promise, I'll show you next time." Their chests touched. They breathed heavily. Ollie stopped wriggling to give her another tempting smile.
"And what good are the promises of someone who lies to her own grandmother?"
She kissed his lips briefly and pulled away. "Another day, I mean it." She kissed him again. "Just... not today." Ollie leaned forward and kissed her. Makani squirmed to shed her coat and got tangled in its sleeves. They both laughed as he helped her out of it.
"I'm curious."
"Why I'm wearing a heavy coat? Because it snowed? And I grew up on the beach?"
"I'm curious," he said, "why you're a winter goth."
She was about to kiss him again, but this made her stop. "What?" Your summer clothes are colorful, and your winter clothes are black.
He motioned at her coat and sweater to prove his point, and then inclined his head for more kissing, as if he hadn't just initiated a weird conversation. Makani pulled back so that he couldn't reach her mouth. The summer clothes were her old clothes. In Hawaii, the warmest items she'd needed were jeans and a hoodie. Here, she'd had to ask her grandmother to buy her a coat, hat, scarf, gloves, and sweaters. They'd made a special trip to a mall in Omaha, and she'd selected everything in black. She couldn't explain why, except that when she wore it, she felt a bit more protected, a bit more hardened. But that sounded dumb, and she didn't want Ollie to think she was copying him or Alex. She teased him instead.
I like that you pay so much attention to what I'm wearing.
I always pay attention to you. I always see you.
Her skin flushed as she held his gaze.
I see you too.
Their bodies connected in a frantic crush. His hoodie disappeared, and then her sweater, and then his shirt. They were on her bed, and her jeans were off, and she was only in her underwear. She reached for his zipper. Ollie placed a hand over hers.
Is this okay? Are you sure?
These were the questions that required honesty.
Yes, she said. Are you?
Yes.
She kissed him again, gently pushing aside his hand. Yes, she repeated.
Yes, he repeated.
The boy with the pink hair was asleep, and her grandmother had texted 30 minutes earlier that traffic was moving, but it was still slow. They had at least another hour. Makani replied, "No prob, keep me updated." Her favorite song blasted through the speaker as she contemplated the rise and fall of Ollie's bare chest. His stomach was flat, much flatter than hers, and he looked more content in slumber than he did when he was awake. He looked soothed. The sex had been surprising, and not only because it had been quiet, just in case, it had been different from their first time. It had been better. It had been more. Makani watched Ollie until thirst overpowered her. She redressed, tugged a blanket over him, and went downstairs into the kitchen. The flatware drawer was open. Her pulse spiked. Grandma? Apart from the tick of the grandfather clock, the house was silent. Makani closed the drawer with a shaking hand. She can't be home yet. She rewound an hour to their arrival, trying to remember if the drawer had been open when they'd passed through the room. She didn't think so, but, admittedly, she'd been distracted. It must have been open. Her grandmother must have opened it before leaving for her appointment. It was good that she'd gone to the specialist. Maybe they would finally get some answers. Makani filled a plastic cup with tap water and chugged it. She refilled it for Ollie, but then decided to use the downstairs bathroom, her grandmother's bathroom, before returning. With the loud music, she didn't think he'd be able to hear her peeing in the upstairs bathroom, but she was still self-conscious about it. When she returned to the kitchen, the flatware drawer was open. Her body lurched to a halt. She gaped at it from the threshold. The tracks must be loose. It's been rolling itself open this whole time. But a lump thickened inside her throat. Makani wasn't sure why she felt afraid. She glanced at the back door, but it was locked. She glanced behind her, but she was alone. Of course she was alone. She crept into the kitchen and pushed in the drawer just a few inches, testing it, waiting for it to roll back out. It didn't. She pushed in the drawer all the way, waited. Still nothing. Maybe Grandma is right. Maybe I really am the one losing my mind. The thought was unsettling because it could be true.
A period of time did exist that was difficult for Makani to remember. Perhaps these recent forgetful occurrences were remnants of her past trauma. Or perhaps...